how we start.
This is Ryan Hogan.
And this is Mike Redding.
And this is broadcasting from the cross. No, I don't really know what it is. I just wanted to put that out there. I'm just along for the ride. But anyway, I'll let Micah, you know, introduce us, introduce the show.
Right. I was kind of thinking of, like, something like Christianity on the Edge or something, because I'm kind of thinking that whatever we talk about will be, like, pretty out there. Sorry, let me just fill
up my... Sorry, Micah, at my suggestion, I said we should brew some coffee while we're recording this. And I don't know if that makes for the most optimal recording conditions. It really doesn't, because Micah, you know, leaves the source of the microphone and then adds all these ambient sounds.
I think the ambient... Okay, so it's making... So the ambient sounds are good. But, yeah, I think that... I don't know what we will call this. We can figure that out later.
Christianity on the curve.
Yeah.
But I think we were going to use the curve for the other podcast.
I think we should use the curve for everything, because that's where everything is. But
what about curbing Christianity?
Curbing Christianity.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, so okay, here's what kind of provoked this in my mind. So I was reading this essay by Paul Graham, the guy who kind of, I guess, started Y Combinator. That's his name, right? Paul Graham?
Sure.
I think that's right.
You know, I don't.
Anyway, and he wrote this essay about the history of philosophy. And I guess, you know, when he went to school, he studied philosophy.
Yeah, everybody, anyone who's anyone studied philosophy.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Ryan, you're going to be the resident philosopher of the show, but here's what... Actually, the article was linked because he... I think it was Venkatesh Rao, or however you say that, who linked it, and I think he was a little bit critical of it. But here was Paul Graham's premise, is that Aristotle kind of kicked off philosophy, and what he did was he started with the presumption that philosophy is the study of things that are not useful. And so everything that he wrote about in, like, his metaphysics or whatever was steered in the direction of, like, it can't be included if it has any usefulness whatsoever.
This is Aristotle.
Yeah.
In metaphysics.
Yeah. And so the reason he approached that was that, you know, he saw that some people would study to know more about their trade and they would get better at it, but then some people would study things that they were just curious about, and they would find stuff out about it, and it wouldn't necessarily have any use. And what Paul Graham points out is, like, the fact that you study something just because you're curious doesn't mean it can't have any use. In fact, finding out principles of reality on a high scale is very useful. And the fact then that Aristotle steered away from anything that could be of any use kind of means he just kind of went into some nonsense that really didn't have anything to do with much of anything by the very basis of what he started with. And so his premise was that was what happened to most of Western philosophy.
Western philosophy. Anyway, so...
Yeah. It became, like, based on this whole thing, how can we talk about stuff that doesn't have any value? And so he suggested...
You know, the branch of philosophy, what is that one that deals with value? You're talking about the valuelessness of everything. What is that?
Nihilism?
Axiology?
I don't know.
I'm just throwing, you know.
Put some terms in there. That's what makes it.
I haven't used those terms in years, so I'm losing them.
Right.
Yeah. I think it's axiology, but I'm sure there's some pedants out there that can.
Correct.
Oh, wait, what is that word? Captious. The captious. Captious audience, not the captive audience. Yeah, anyway, yeah.
So his suggestion is that philosophy can be rebuilt on a different principle. He said...
On a new paradigm,
Because
everyone loves that word, paradigm. Oh, can I...
Paradigmatic.
Can I tell you an an anecdote that has nothing to do with theology, except that I went to a very Christian, very, very conservative Christian school. There was an honors professor. You know, there was a professor doing an honors forum discussion on his PhD defense, and he was a physical education professor, basically. Yeah, I took honors PE with him, essentially. Anyway, so he was talking about his dissertation, and one of my fellow students was like, I did this exact same project my senior year of high school, and he kept saying paradigm. Yeah. I was like, how do you get a doctorate and not know how to pronounce paradigm correctly? Anyway, that's very extraneous, and I apologize.
I love it. I like to use many paradigms myself. And so, So, what this guy suggested that philosophy be rebuilt on was the idea of that it was searching for general principles that applied in you know, the most universal cases that they could find, guided by the...
voices. I mean, sorry.
Right, yeah. The need to have practical value. And so the practical value would be measured by whether it would change what people would actually do after reading it. So you read it, does it change what you do? If so, then, you know, then we're kind of like, we are saying that it kind of has some substance to it. It means something actually in the real world. So does that make sense? Does that kind of...
Yeah, that makes sense to me, but I don't know if I would view philosophy, all of Western philosophy, the way that this individual...
Right.
I mean, well, see, here's the thing about me. When I was very religious, I knew the answers. I knew how to defend it. When I was really, you know, into being an artist, I could say all the right things in defense of that. And there was a time when I could defend philosophy. Mm. And the merit of philosophy. Right now, I don't know if I can do it. But I don't know. That's I'm not on my A game when it comes to philosophical endeavors. But that, I don't know. I'm kind of skeptical of all Western philosophy. Yeah. He'll make that assertion, or just bits and pieces here and there.
I think he was just...
Well, there is a lot that is kind of... I don't like. I just remember reading people like Barclay. It's like, you know, talking about, is this table a table, or is it just exhibiting the qualities of a table? I'm like, well, what's the point of that?
Right.
But I guess if it is getting down to our core existence, you know, there is merit.
Just going to pour some coffee in.
Because what's theology talk without
right.
a nice cup of coffee?
Well, I don't think he was saying that every philosopher was like that. He was just saying that that's, in general, the problem with philosophy, and the reason why it's so hard to tell good philosophy from bad philosophy.
And pig philosophy, and... Sorry.
Is there's just not any way to evaluate it. So, I propose... you're getting some cream? I'll take some.
Okay. I didn't know if you were giving up cream this week or not.
No. What I'm doing this week...
You're going to take a vow of silence, right?
After this. No, I think I'm going to take a vow of 5-hour energy every day. So,
like Limitless.
Right,
Last time you did that, it's like Limitless.
It was like
you had to, like, wean yourself up, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway.
It's pretty crazy. Anyway, I'm just coming off, for our listeners, I'm just coming off a week of no coffee and getting back on coffee, so... Anyway, what I was saying
is, careful there.
I think that that's how I would like to approach theology. I think that that's pretty much the problem with theology is it's by cutting loose from any kind of discussion of practical value, it, you know, drifts off into this kind of metaphysical speculation about things that don't mean much of anything
to us in the physical world.
Right. And we are in the physical world, and I think the category of metaphysics has some real problems. And so I would like to kind of rethink how theology is done with an eye to always gauging what its practical value is. And in defense of that, I would say that's the approach of science. Like, in science, you observe the world, you come up with a theory or a hypothesis about what how the world works. When you do so, then that theory has to have some ramifications. And so when Einstein proposed the theory of relativity, he had observed that the light was behaving in strange ways. He came up with a hypothesis of why it might be behaving in those ways. And then he saw the ramifications of that. He said, based on my hypothesis, if this is true, then in this weird situation that we wouldn't normally encounter in real life, we would see this particular thing happen. And so eventually they set up that situation and tested it out, and sure enough, that particular thing happened, and that indicates that his theory is true. And true in that case means it works. It predicts what's going to happen. When you fly a clock 10,000 feet in the air, it behaves the way that he said it would, not the way that other people said it would. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, yeah, we need to approach theology that way.
Yeah.
I didn't want to comment on
floating
the cream curdled, and I'm really kind of disturbed by that.
Should I just drink around it? Is that?
Just don't worry about it. Yeah.
Okay.
No fear, no qualms.
No fear, huh?
Yeah, that's the way I live about my theology. Yeah. No fear, and no qualms.
So, right.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
So like, if you take the idea of the thief on the cross.
Ooh.
Yeah. Oh, he was in paradise, wherever paradise is. Right. That's all he said, paradise. But yeah. So we could just like apply that in all kinds of situations, you know? Right? We can just...
Yeah, I guess. Wait, what does that mean?
I don't know. never mind. Anyway.
Well, okay, so that... that's how I am trying to reconfigure theology. And it's hard because once you start talking about something that somebody else has talked about, you're quickly into a mire of definitions and ideas that may or may not have much practical value, or it's hard to see the practical value. So I guess I would start, and I may be running off a cliff here, but I guess I would start with talking about what it means to believe in the existence of God.
Mm.
So, yes.
Yeah.
So, it's a really kind of weird thing because I think when most people talk about it, it's almost like a separate issue. Like, we can talk about proving or disproving the existence of God over in this box, and then we can kind of talk about what God is like and all this kind of stuff over in this box. And
what about that box over there?
That box is usually left empty, but sometimes people put extra stuff they find, you know.
So. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah.
So when I approach this, I start thinking about what it means to believe in the existence of anybody. So, so Ryan, just kind of cut in if you don't follow what I'm saying here, because I'm not sure if it's very comprehensible. But
yeah, sometimes you're incomprehensible, and sometimes I'm just dense. So the combination makes it difficult for us.
Well, I think that's, but that's good because there are many people out there who are both dense and find me incomprehensible. So, you know. I think that works for this discussion.
Okay.
So,
right. I'm the laity here.
The laity.
And you're the clergy.
I'm the clergy, huh?
Yeah.
Can I get a official title? Actually, I think I got
one. Oh, I thought you were going to be like, can I get an amen? I don't know.
Can I get a raised hand? A tearful eye? Yeah.
Oh, we're not on video.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, When I think about the existence of, you know, people I know, I think
this is where Barclay comes in.
No. Oh.
Anyways.
Well, sorry. Okay, so there's I think a big question in philosophy, going back to that, of how do you know that someone else really exists? or has a consciousness or something. And so, you know, I talk to you. I don't really know.
Now that, we're getting into solipsism.
Yes. Yeah, and the solipsist, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the expert on this kind of stuff.
I'm not really, but I'll give it a go.
But I would say, like, the solipsist says, well, I can know that I'm conscious.
Yeah.
But I don't know that anybody else is conscious. I might as well assume they're not.
I don't know if you have to make the assumption that they're not, but, yeah.
There's just no way of knowing.
I don't know if this ties in at all, but Descartes. Descartes was defeatingly solipsistic, because when he, you know, uttered or wrote whatever, mm-hmm. those seminal words, I think, therefore I am,
mm-hmm.
the only thing he was doing was convincing himself of his own existence. So he went from establishing this very solipsistic, what's the word? Solipsistic mantra.
Mantra, yeah.
Yeah, whatever. And then he went to try to prove God's existence, which was quite a stretch.
Yeah.
Because, again, at the very most, yeah, he only was able to convince himself that he was real.
Right.
Yeah.
So how could he even convince, yeah, anybody else that he was real, much less that, you know.
God is real. Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I don't know. A lot of people hate Descartes. He kind of ruined the way we think. Right?
Yeah. Here would be my counter argument to solipsism. Or to that idea. Yeah.
You believe everyone else is conscious, but you're not?
Right.
Oh.
The opposite. No. I think that the only basis on which we have to evaluate anything is the experiences we have. Or we might say in a more general way, like our relationship with something. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I can't get in somebody's mind and analyze whether they're conscious or not.
Oh, sorry. I'm making too many asides.
No.
You know how everyone is... You know, we have social media now, everybody's on curation.
Mm.
Well, I thought at one point in time in the future, and maybe this is the wrong podcast to be talking about this, you know, our consciousness would be on view for others. So I thought, I need to start curating.
Curating your own consciousness.
Yes. But then there are areas of my consciousness that I'm not even aware of, so... Maybe someone else would need to curate those.
This would be a good discussion for our Singularity podcast. This is, yeah, that's, you know, Christians, we're not just, you know, we're not comfortable with those kind of conversations, so.
Oh, yeah, I don't want people to see inside my right. mind. It's a scary place.
Yeah.
But you know what? I can, that's all right, you know, because that's what I've been taught. I can come as I am, you know. Mm. Yeah.
Come as you are, yeah.
Just as I am.
Yeah.
Anyway, but.
Saints and sinners.
I got you off track, but what were you saying?
I was saying that I think that that the only way we have to know anything, in particular, in this case, to know anything about other people, is just our experience of them. And so I don't have any direct experience of the consciousness of the people that are around me. But I believe that they're conscious. I believe that they have real feelings and all this kind of stuff, because that's my interaction with them. That's my relation with them and my experience of them. And I think it's I want to say idiotic, to presume that to know that they exist means some kind of a metaphysical leap or something. We know that they exist because we interact with them, and they act as if they exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's what it means to know in any kind of real sense. Once again, going back to practical.
If you take
reality.
It as a scientific approach, I mean, you know. Well, I mean, I guess you know you exist, but
yeah.
Based on every time you experience something, until you experience it a different way, you just go with that.
Yeah.
So, I guess we only have our own experience, but we know how we operate. We think we are individually are conscious beings. So until we're convinced that other people are not, we should just go with everyone being conscious beings and not have to live these isolating solipsistic realities.
Yeah. Well, I think that until someone can demonstrate a meaningful difference between someone who appears to be a real human being and someone who actually is a real human being, which that's never been, you know, there's no reason to think that that distinction makes any sense, but people have invented this distinction. So, yeah, I would say not only the assumption, but by all the definitions we have access to that make any sense to us, we have to operate on the basis that other people have a consciousness, have feelings, have emotions, and are real in a substantial way. So does that follow me?
Yeah, I follow. So, okay. I follow, yeah, yeah.
All right, so when we talk about the existence of God, then that's the same sort of thought process or argument that we have to engage in. God is trickier because... Because he's so tricky. Because there is no object which we can kind of locate God in, right? Whereas the human being, we, you know, grab an object and we say this is a human being and we think there's a mind in there somewhere. And we don't have an object like that to locate God. God is not present in our universe as an object. And that's kind of the fundamental reality we have to...
Unless you're like a pantheist.
Or unless you have a particularly great idol. So we have to say, okay, if we're going to figure out whether or not God exists, what are we going to look for? And we're not going to look for an object because we don't have an object. And so most of us, I think, intuitively would locate our relationship with God kind of as the background reality of life or the world. Like, you know, most people say, oh, you know, thank you, God, for this and that and so forth.
They do a TiVo on the playing field.
Thanks for that touchdown or whatever. I think, you know, most people know that the way that they relate to God is in some sense coming from, you know, the reality that surrounds them, the kind of background of their existence and so forth. And I think there's a lot that we can critique about that and say maybe that's overly simplistic. But I think that's where we have to look. We have to look at our experience of reality and of the world and kind of the universe and say, does this indicate a kind of caring, a kind of mind, sort of a kind of intelligent sort of way of operating that would indicate, you know, something we can relate to. In the same way that when I look at a human body, the difference between a human body that has, you know, what we would say no soul, or a human body that has, you know, a personhood in it, is whether, you know, how it relates to us, how it interacts with us, whether it talks and so forth. And I think that's the same way. Is our experience of reality just of this kind of cold, lifeless force, or is it an experience of that, you know, that indicates compassion and intelligence and creativity and all these things? Does that work?
It works for me.
It works for you. So, I think it's useful to talk about kind of the metaphysical nature of God in a sense, but only in regards to what does that mean for how we should expect to interact with God in a practical sense. You know, so it's very common in the tradition of Western Christianity to think of God as entirely outside of the universe and just intervening at small moments. And I would say that description is only useful in such that it says, well, we should only expect God to show up periodically and occasionally. And then there are other descriptions of how God interacts with the universe that say, well, we should expect God to show up all the time, or to God to be involved in these different ways.
And then, you know, there are time... Well, there are...
people.
Yeah, people. And I guess I've been one of them that just God doesn't show up at all.
Right, so, yeah, and I think...
He's there, but he's not listening.
Well, that's a very, you know, a very common experience, not just in, you know, humanity, but also in the
Bible.
Well,
I always just, oh, yeah, yeah.
Job
the
and all that.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking maybe some Psalms.
Yeah, you can dig.
You can dig, find some Psalms.
Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah, when I've had my deistic feelings, those are the worst.
Mm. Yeah.
Those are worse than God not being there at all.
Yeah. Well, so that's, you know, I think that's a very, I think deism, for some reason, you know, which deism as is normally defined as this idea that God started things, but then just kind of left. And I guess that makes, or made some people fairly happy, because they could feel like the universe was running by some very mechanistic principles, but there was still a God out there somewhere. But I think that the deism, when looked at just through practicality, which is what we're trying to bring to this, basically is indistinguishable from atheism. Maybe it's worse than atheism because it's a God who left rather than a God.
It is worse than atheism. But anyway, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. That's where I'm. That's how I kind of frame this and think about this. And I think, the you know, I'd like to talk about all these kind of Christian theologies and the Bible and so forth. But I think we kind of have to keep coming back to the real world that we experience and what that means for
We have to take an existential approach.
Ooh, yes.
Because Christianity is... for a large part, just an existential response to, what are we doing here?
Yeah, yeah.
It's giving meaning to a seemingly meaningless existence.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Should we keep going, or is that a good place to wrap up?
Well, I am supposed to go meet my friends soon.
Your friends. Gotta
go to Burger Up.
Yeah.
I haven't been yet. I don't know what I'm going to get.
Burger Up.
Yeah, Burger Up, they did have a booth at the Best of Nashville party, but I wasn't feeling very hungry. And that's really a shame, because there was a lot of good food, and it was free. Anyway, but...
And that's a good point to close on.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. If this makes sense to anybody out there, and
if anyone's listening,
the proverbial listener, yeah,
God, if you're out there,
right. Then we you know, might be interested in continuing the conversation. So you
via
know,
Skype? No, just kidding.
Yeah. So send us some thoughts. You know, that kind
send
of
us
stuff.
Some thoughts.
Yeah, prayers.
Wait,
you know,
questions, comments, smart remarks.
Right.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All those kind of things.
Yeah, because we know the trolls are out there.
Some jokes.
You know, I saw a fortune once that said, don't give your goals to trolls.
Nice.
And with that, yeah, I think those are some words to live by. And with that, we're out of here.
All right.